Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in South Asia, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sneha Annavarapu, the host of this channel, and today I'm thrilled to be in conversation with Sudhir Chalarajan, author of Social Theory of Corruption, Notes from the Indian Subcontinent, published by Harvard University Press in 2020. Professor Rajan teaches at the Department of Humanities and Social Sciences at the Indian Institute of Technology, Madras. I must add here that I am an alum of that department, and having the pleasure of taking Professor Rajan's courses, I'm doubly delighted to be doing this interview today. Thanks so much for joining me today, Chala.
Thanks. Thank you, Sneha. It's been lovely to be invited and to be here.
Yeah, it's like a full circle, you know, from me taking your classes to doing this now. So I'm really pumped about this. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself to start off the interview, perhaps your journey into academia and into research?
Yeah, sure. So it feels like only yesterday, but I've been at IIT for about 14 years actually. And prior to that, another 7 or 8 years I spent in Boston, and then I was in India before that. So I've had a sort of a checkered journey post my doctorate, which wasn't a true PhD. It's called Doctor of Environmental Science and Engineering. It was the most wonderful decision I made to join that program because it taught me to be a master of all of none, really, a jack of all trades. And so the idea was really cool because we were asked to think about an anti-PhD to become generalists. So I came with a background in engineering and natural sciences, atmospheric science, to be more precise. And then I kind of wandered off into law departments, philosophy, political theory, urban studies, and so on, in order to fulfill my course requirements. And then I was packaged off to go, you know, get a job somewhere, where I spent 5 years writing my dissertation. So it was a very, you know, unique kind of doctoral experience. And that kind of led me in various possible directions. And but I'm glad I kind of got a book that I'm very proud of from that, The Enigma of Automobility, which, I'm very happy to hear you having encountered as well. Thank you.
Yes.
So, but since then, I mean, I never really got the kind of academic position I was coveting. Instead, I was in a variety of wonderful jobs, which taught me a lot. But I also had to fend for money, you know, being mostly a research consultant. And somewhere along that point of being a research consultant, I worked mostly on energy and climate change and so on, but I also had the opportunity to start thinking a little bit about institutions, political institutions in particular, in relation to the electricity sector at first, and then more broadly when I got this wonderful grant from the U.S. State Department, a blue sky grant to sort of explore corruption. So it was a bit of a shock to get that grant, but it was very timely, and I learned a lot about the domain that I finally came to. But I'm sorry to keep going on about this, because I did spend the last 14 years as mostly as a teacher. And that taught me, encountering students like yourself, just taught me a lot more about the field of political theory, social and political theory, particularly in relation to institutions and corruption. So I think that's where I got the inspiration to really start work on this book.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit more, perhaps? How did you decide to write a book about it? Or was it always at the back of your mind? And did you just, have you been working on this book for a very long time? We would just love to know more of the details behind the story of this book.
Yeah, so 2003-04 was when I was at the Telus Institute in Boston. And I applied for this grant I told you about, the U.S. State Department grant. And it was just a two and a half year grant, and I got a very interesting project with the help of some wonderful colleagues out of it. If you go to institutionalreform.org, it kind of explains the directions we took with that project. But most importantly, I think it kind of exposed me to this very broad literature on corruption, and very timely too, because the countries of the world had just signed and ratified this UN Convention on Anti-Corruption, which was a big deal. It sort of came out of the US trying to put pressure on terrorist finance networks and so on, to sort of deal with money laundering. And then so transnational crime was seen as a necessary focus. And out of that, this wonderful convention actually emerged. And, out of some contingent crisis circumstances, I always feel, we had some opportunities for wonderful democratic or Republican ideals, right? So the UN Convention on Anti-Corruption was important for many respects, because it also helped shift the burden of corruption from what I've been calling, and along with many others, petty corruption, or the just individual bribes or even administrative forms of bribe collection and so on, to the importance of networks, of crime. So around this time also, there was a lot of very interesting literature coming out, Vincent Ruggiero, for instance, on white-collar crime. Vincenzo Ruggiero, I was just being lazy. So this was an exciting time to study corruption, as it were, right? And then a few years later, we had several key events around the world. One was, of course, Citizens United in the U.S., which allowed corporations to provide freely to electoral campaigns in the U.S. And that's turns out to be a very huge way to sort of hide illegally earned money, but also just political contributions. I mean, one of the worst things that anti-corruption experts fear, that you sort of loosen up political campaign finance, and this is precisely what the Supreme Court did. Right. So these kinds of events led to other literatures around that time. Right. From political scientists, activists, and so on, asking this question: okay, if corruption isn't this conventional bribe taking that everybody is so annoyed about, but it involves these more complex networks and players, then something else ought to be studied. So we should start focusing on other things. And this was also largely, I would think, reaction to donor policy. So the way the World Bank had defined corruption in particular ways, and donors appropriately picked up, they gave their monies to fund certain types of anti-corruption campaigns. So some of those were good, they rationalize the bureaucracy to some extent, things like that. But the focus on deviance, on bureaucratic deviance, was so powerful that even to this day, with well-meaning colleagues, I'm constantly arguing about why they're confusing this notion of informality with corruption. So rules not being followed, it becomes an informal negotiation, and therefore that's automatically corruption. And I keep asking, why aren't you focusing on the larger networked, really the social character of corruption? So that's roughly where I kind of found myself going. I mean, I could go on in this way, but I think you were kind enough to share some of your thoughts as to how this interview might proceed. So I know you have other things that you'd want to ask me, and I'll weave some of these narratives in.
Yeah, no, I think that was a great way to introduce perhaps what I was going to go for next, which is that the book very usefully puts forth a social theory of corruption. And as you put it, you view corruption as a social institution that's relatively stable and reproduces itself, and you emphasize the role of networks in particular. I was actually curious, you've already answered that it's responding to certain other approaches, which, for instance, looking at bureaucratic deviance, which political science and I guess economics has done to a large extent. But I was also curious to know why South Asia was a particularly ripe site for your inquiry, and whether you were always interested in writing, I think, a rather ambitious history of sorts, right? Like a genealogy, at least, of corruption in the subcontinent. So why South Asia, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. And I think you've in a sense, also invited me to weave both parts of your, question. In the sense that why sociological or why social theory of corruption and why India? And I think the two are linked in the following way, in that let me begin by saying who I'm responding to, and that might answer this question a little more clearly. Who or what I'm responding to is methodological individualism, which puts forth this quite absurd argument that you can indeed define corruption simply as this ability to write incentives or to provide the right incentives for people to act justly, right? So it's sort of, I think, presumes this ring of Gyges top of such sort of framework, where in Plato's Republic, Glaucon postulates, what if, you had a ring that made you invisible and you wouldn't get caught? Would it be okay for the just to become thereby unjust? Right? And so that becomes a sort of a default natural assumption about human incentive and motivation and behavior, and that kind of then feeds the rest of the narrative. So methodological individualism, which sort of drives this, doesn't even have the kind of Weberian sophistication to it, where you could sort of talk about relationships and power and so on, right? So I think that's the definition of corruption. And I suspect, and I don't have the skills obviously to pursue this line of thinking, but I suspect that my own theory of corruption would explain this type of theorizing, right? The methodological individualism and that dominance. So it's a very terrible rabbit hole to go down, and I was thrilled to go to these conferences and learn about the literature that was really shattering that framework, and yet wondering why it wasn't becoming more widespread in policy, right? And so on. So those were some of the ideas that were starting to motivate me, and I realized that around the same time I was thinking about what various types of new methods in the social sciences, especially around big history, were revealing. I've been following Dipesh Chakravarti very closely for sort of trying to understand my own epistemology, my own motivation for wanting to look at India's deep past and so on. And this this question of big history as an ontological possibility opened up to me. And this and around the same time, I was also teaching Durkheim and his positivism, and there was the Anthropocene, and you know, all of these themes were starting to become salient in variously interesting ways. And it just struck me, and this was completely on a whim. I happened to meet this editor, the publisher from Harvard University Press, because Ram Guha very kindly introduced her to me. And I met her in my office, and she was asking me what I was doing, and I hadn't been completely prepared. I was actually thinking of two or three themes having to do with, the climate catastrophe and so on. And I just blurted out, you know, what's a long history of corruption look like to you? And she was so wonderful and so patient with me that for the next several weeks, we were, you know, working quite closely to try and hone this, to make this into something presentable. And then when the proposal was approved, I was still, you know, struggling with this question. So I knew I had this large tapestry. I'm not sure if you've heard this story, maybe it's just apocryphal. Martin Amis was asked when Rushdie got the Booker Prize for Midnight's Children, Martin Amis was asked, well, don't you feel bad about not getting it yourself? And Rushdie is he's a later writer than you. And and Martin said, well, Rushdie's got India. Right, so I felt this very orientalist thrill, if you like, of getting into the meat of the matter. So I think I was just rushing along with no clear intent in mind, except that I was excited about the possibilities that this other literature, that I could potentially stand on the shoulders of many giants to sort of start exploring this as speculatively and as, wantonly as I needed to, because, that's one of the wonderful things about academia. That's another subject, right? Once you're a tenured professor, you feel completely at liberty to explore anything in any which way you want, as long as, you follow certain rules. So I think that's what led me down this path about 6 years ago, so I must say I'm a little surprised by the outcome, but it also stands apart from me, the book. So I see it now as something that I'll have to, I'm forced to defend, but also is at some distance from me.
Yeah, and I guess it sort of takes a life of its own after it's out there in the world, and I'm sure you'll be, I guess, amused when people cite it in ways that you perhaps did not intend, as it always happens. coming back to the South Asia question a little, how did writing about the Indian subcontinent, I guess, was it, how did it change the way you thought about corruption? Did it? Or, what were the affordances of doing so?
Yeah. So to be honest, I was feeling rather intimidated by a question that Dipesh Chakravarti poses. He says, who speaks of Indian past? And I felt, dare I, get into this? And I even sort of engaged with a little bit of what I thought was a friendly tussle with Dipesh. But I was also sort of distracted by other themes that became relevant. I mean that it's not just that you are thinking about South Asia as an already contested domain of historiography to sort of do something and muck it up, or the other way of thinking about this is, where do we in a sense explore macro sociology? If the tradition has been to do this largely in Europe, and if that tradition and maybe more recently in say places like China, and South Asia's deep past have always sort of seem disconnected from the present because of the legacy of colonialism. Maybe one way to sort of sidestep this question is to really start using methods that are now, you know, sort of legitimized by the academy, you know, big history and so on. So this was, again, you know, a very foolhardy plan of mine. And I felt foolhardy about pulling it off only because I come from a tradition where I've been sort of window shopping in the social sciences. I don't really feel committed to being a sociologist or a political scientist or anything else. So that's an unfortunate hubris on my part. But I think it was helpful to me in not, and I haven't been to many conferences, so people haven't, you know, told me face to face that what I'm saying is rubbish. So I've sort of had a fairly privileged life in doing this. So the honestly, the exploration of India is also because I, you know, had this childhood ambition of being a historian of ancient India, of early India, rather, right? Somehow I never got to do this, so it seemed like the perfect opportunity to do this. So seriously, my most exciting part of my journey was working on Harappa, and because I read a whole lot of archaeology and so on, and of that period, and it felt complete and exhaustive, and I knew I couldn't do that, especially as I got to more recent times. So I've had colonial historians tell me, you know, without necessarily sort of condemning the work as a whole as a result of that criticism, but telling me that I don't explore enough of these, you know, of colonialism's corruption, right? And I admit it. I mean, I just feel that that's actually been said in so many ways. So I don't really need to repeat that narrative, and that literature is also considerably beyond me. Capabilities of my kind of dilettantism to realize. Right? So South Asia, the South Asia question is a tough one, I'll admit. It makes me uncomfortable, but it also makes me that when I start exploring the reasons for my discomfort, I also feel more justified than ever to sort of assert it, right? And so that's also something that I need to think about separately here.
I thought this is really useful to hear you speak about these sorts of dilemmas that one wrestles with. It's always interesting to hear authors speak because I think the writing voice is very different. The book is centered around a concept that you called grand corruption, which is, you say, facilitated by elite networks. So I was actually going to ask you a question that I had tucked away for later, but I was going to slide it into this one as well. Is, could you tell us a little bit about what corruption, grand corruption, means, and how, I guess, is it different from a Marxist reading of corruption? Because in a sense, you are also looking at longer-term patterns of systemic exploitation, and, you know, like thinking about them in relation to patriarchy and forced labor. So how is this, I guess, different from a Marxist reading? And is it different from a Marxist reading, and why? Yeah.
No, those are important questions. And let me first say where the term comes from, grand corruption. Yeah. It comes from this typology, which I think Susan Rose Ackerman was the first to use, although I could be wrong. I've seen it in other contexts as well, of petty, administrative, and grand corruption. And petty corruption is has to do with the street level exchange of favors with bureaucrats, right, of various sorts. And administrative is that plus, so that, you know, bundled into offices and arrangements, you know, maybe going up to ministers and so on. So it doesn't really matter how, even if it's at the level of political campaigns, it's still considered just administrative corruption. Grand corruption is used to talk about the political system, the very legitimacy of the political system, resting on a set of betrayals, if you will. So Francis Fukuyama very helpfully described the U.S. after the 1980s as sort of falling into this kind of grand corruption, in the sense that excessive legislative control and creating and sort of judicial distance because of the very nature of the institutional relationships, and political, lobbying and all that going on in the background, but completely legitimate. Right? So all of these working in collusion to create a kind of a system out of which you really can't get out of. Right? You can't do accounting reform. You can't do there's all kinds of examples of ways in which the U.S. legislative process had allowed for a systematic or systemic corruption. And there's a wonderful book out by Zephyr Teachout called Corruption in America, which really speaks to that. So what grand corruption implies is that there's a particular nexus of wealth and power that produces these routines and these ways that you're locked into, that are so formalized or institutionalized that you really don't know what else to do. What I found really exciting in my literature search was Michael Johnston's work, where in his Syndromes of Corruption, he has a remarkable and hybrid array of methods to classify different countries into different syndromes. So he has this term, oligarchs and clans, the Trump regime today probably resembles that, but it was really classic of Philippines under the Marcoses, Putin and Yeltsin's Russia, etc. Right. So the U.S. he calls I think influence markets. There's influence markets, there's elites and elite cartels, official moguls, etc. Right? So there are these four classes or syndromes of grand corruption. Now, once you start describing grand corruption in these ways, you realize that it's endemic to these societies. And I don't want to say, I mean, certainly Johnston doesn't, and I don't either. I don't want to sort of have this tragic crisis mode to it, which certain versions of Hegelian Marxism might. And so that's the challenge. How do we think of these assemblages as having, these non-determinate emergent outcomes? And when do these emergent outcomes, in a sense, have this recurrence of tragedy because they fall into identifiable patterns or syndromes? And so that seemed like Johnston's typology was also consistent with the sort of the realist ontology that I was getting more and more attracted to, especially in light of the work I was doing on climate change and so on. Right. So I think trying to think of grand corruption as a syndrome that not just appears once in some generational lifetime, but actually seems to fester into a social characteristic, I thought was an interesting hypothesis worth pursuing. And again, the tapestry of Indian past seemed just too perfect not to examine for that reason. So they're completely on a whim, fueled by all these different factors, I might say, you know, that kind of got me interested in this project. And then again, like I said, I had no idea where it would go, but it sort of one thing led to another. And, you know, this theme of grand corruption in particular seemed to kind of link it all together.
So that was really helpful. Thanks for elaborating on the theory or theorization of corruption in your book. But I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about where and how does resistance or mass mobilization against corruption feature in this vision or in this conceptualization of corruption?
That's a really important question, Sneha. And I think it has to do with this Republican spirit that seems to be implicit in the very word for corruption. Corruption stands for something rotten in almost all languages that I've explored. For instance, brashtachar in Sanskrit is to rot. The word in Tamil is ural. In Chinese, it's fubai. The old English is karamp. It's rottenness, decay, and so on. A society rots when its soul is blurry. And its soul is its sense of collective purpose. And I think that aspiration for collective purpose is expressed through forms of civic humanism, just ways of making ourselves joyful. And you see this in a whole series of historical plebeian events. And in our times, you know, the constitutional sparks of a constitutional republic. I think that's the constituent moment of transformation from corruptions of various sorts. And I don't think it's always successful. I mean, there are continuities between pre-revolutionary and post-revolutionary times. And at the present moment, I'm starting to feel that we are in a kind of this Victor Turner moment. I don't know if you've seen these words of his where he says that from time to time, society wants to take a look at itself, a slice of itself. And when it does so, it sort of sees something liminal. And so it does so often in this ritual manner, right, of engaging in this liminality. And somehow the entire Trump era, sort of culminating in the Capitol attack, seems to me be that kind of moment, and it's that's why it's very Durkheimian in that sense. You know, his description of football events and so on, and I feel why not, you know, take this hypothesis to looking at longer time frames. Okay? And why not do this in over a longer time frames? And if one were to do that, you know, what forms of transformation do you see? And in India's long past, I think we very clearly see the Dharma age as representing some critical challenge and transformation and some very complex themes within it as well. And so resistance, yes, but it's really a kind of a transformative, non-revolutionary, slow festering, but, you know, still possible to see as a kind of a counter hegemony at work. And that's something that seems to me to have the sort of the very haziest of meanings and you know, visions. So I can't describe that beyond that as you know, of even seeing evidence of anything beyond that. But the present moment is sort of ripe with possibilities, and it's also so urgent, right? And I think that's the thing that concerns me most. And here it is the stories around kings and queens that bother me the most, right? That we take them so much for granted. They're so much part of our ideology in ways that we can't even fully express. And so I wonder, you know, if I were more skilled, I'd be doing research into looking at Leviathan type images across various state formations, right? Either explicitly or not. So I'm very curious about how those are really hiding these elite nodes of power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in a sense, in the book, you trace the genealogy of corruption through what you call big intervals in the region's history. And in chapter 4, 5, 6, you walk us through the Harappan and Vedic civilization until the rise of the Mauryas. So while it's impossible, of course, to get at the depth of everything you've written, I wanted to invite you to speak a little bit on a couple of very intriguing arguments you make in this section of the book. And it, I guess, is a continuation from what we've been discussing until now. But first, you sort of bring up the question of habitus and link it to corruption, and you do this specifically with reference to the Vedic age. So I wanted to ask you, what does the body and bodily practices have to do with political corruption?
Yeah, so I rely on this notion that something about, it seems to me most evident in the lineage of Brahmanism from the Vedic age to the present. I was, my father was raised a Brahmin, a Tamil Brahmin, but he kind of left it deliberately by becoming a theosophist, and I was never raised with any Hindu ritual. But on the other hand, it used to fascinate me because of my everyday encounters with it, and what seems so kind of patent to me is the manner in which it is the sort of the interpolation of body intextualization that in a sense makes up our society and our politics. So both the conditions of life and our ways of living within it are kind of constantly sort of in this dialectic with each other around the mediated through the body, right? And so I think that continuity startles me, particularly in the case of Brahmanism. But you see it across different, transformations and timescales and so on. And it occurs to me that, I mean, obviously I'm projecting backwards from our overly, marketed, commodified age, right? Where every object and every gesture and everything is monetized in some way. But I see these as rent-producing activities. And I'm wondering whether that can be more fully justified. And that's really the heart of my exploration. So in that sense, we spoke earlier about Marxism or the relationship to Marxism, and I don't think I fully answered that at all. But I am rather committed to this idea from Marx, which sort of has its echoes in Piketty and so on, that it's the rent collection activity that produces this extreme, drive for accumulation, territory, and so on. And I don't want to sort of over-psychologize that, of course, but it seems to me that the link between elite network formation or extreme inequality and cultural practices needs some kind of tying up of these loose ends. And there's actually wonderful work on some of this from, people who's, I forget their names, but there was a paper from about 2 decades ago on the Medici in Florence. And their very complex networks deep into various parts of what we would call society, right? Plebeian society. So I think that's a kind of a networked corridor view of territory and power that I think can give us some very clear indications of the connections between body culture and elite network power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, wonderfully articulated. Thank you. And just to follow up on something you mentioned earlier, was actually my second question in this line of thinking about chapter 4, 5, and 6. How exactly does dharma become an ideological prop in the service of corruption, as you put it? Could you elaborate a little bit on that process?
I'm sorry, I think I misheard that question. Could you please repeat it?
Yeah. How does dharma become an ideological prop in the service of corruption? And you started talking about it a little bit, but I thought I would just ask you to elaborate on that.
Yeah, so I'm afraid, you know, I've had the hardest time with that chapter on dharma because of, you know, it's such a vast domain and there's so much that's to be said about dharma. But what interested me most was how you had this, that you first hear about dharma not from the Dharma Sutras or the Dharma Shastras, but from Ashoka's edicts. So it's quite clear that something about Buddhism sparked off this debate on dharma. And it's not just at the level of ideas or philosophy, it's clearly operated through territorial power. So you had a Buddhist emperor, Ashoka, who established his dominance, his territorial dominance across a very large landscape. And then you had, after that, much smaller, but still incipient instances, until the Guptas, of territorial claims made again on dharma, but this time increasingly articulated through a kind of a Brahminical revivalism, but completely reorganized and shaped into a question of dharma. And then you have the great epics, and this is what I find so fascinating. And to me, the Mahabharata is a great, we talked about resistance earlier, it's a great act of resistance. It's a poetic resistance in many ways. And because more than half the book, and I didn't know this, I mean, it's several volumes, of course, but more than half of it is devoted to this very question of dharma. And of course, so Yudhishthira, after the great war, is refuses to take the throne. And this is, again, you know, for me, this very peculiar revelation of what might be at stake. So I find that kind of use of dharma extraordinarily interesting and important for these observations. But again, my readings are completely superficial, and you know it's almost like, you know, I've been a bot going through Wikipedia and picking up relevant themes and stringing them together. And I feel completely ill at ease to talk about some of these histories, especially, you know, with historians around and mm-hmm. so on.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. I mean, but I just wanted to thank you again for taking time out to do this. I just realized that I exhausted my questions, but I felt like we've had such a rich and fulfilling conversation that I really want to thank you for that. But before we end this conversation, could you tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now and what we may expect to read by you in the near future?
Now, that's again a good question, because I've been puzzling over this very issue for a while, because on the one hand, there's so many different exciting directions to go off into, you know, intellectually. And I'd love to do some of those things. I mean, around this question of sovereignty, for instance, this relationship between culture and politics, and you know, epistemological issues around the long durée, etc. But again, in political terms, the need for constitutional republicanism also appeals very much to me. You know, trying to understand, you know, how do we move forward? How do we kind of get out of this? If this hypothesis is indeed true, that we're sort of locked into these corrupt social and cultural practices, and that we need to change bodily habitus, where do we kind of go. I've worked before on automobility, as you know, and this was also, you know, what are alternatives to the automobile in a place like Los Angeles, right? So these are difficult questions around land and social reorganization and so on. And this is where I take great comfort in the agroecology movement of the day. And what Sujata, my partner, and I have discovered is that there's a whole world out there of multiple, pluriverse, if you like, of projects around land and food and food sovereignty, which is quite remarkable because it really takes away rent from the equation of living and living well. And it's not just some utopian Bhutanese experiment we're talking about. We're really talking about things that can truly turn the planet around, heal the planet in several ways through agroecology in particular, and the systems of, you know, social organization and exchange that go around it. So I'm very, very interested in this question as a kind of a speculative, long-term question of sustainability, and at the same time, I'm very glad that there's so many people working on, you know, the craziness of building spaceships to leave Earth, right? And so that's the direction that I feel most drawn towards. And again, doesn't necessarily mean, you know, writing a book or being involved in academic work of that nature. I probably want to, you know, work with filmmakers and others to sort of explore some new directions around this. That's where my creative juices, if you like, would be most keen to move towards. Although, again, this is wishful thinking.
That's very cool. And, you know, all the best with, I guess, thinking about all of these things. And the filmmaking part of it sounds particularly exciting, considering, I think, alternate forms of writing, media are always encouraged, I think, in and around academic and semi-academic spaces. So that's really cool. Well, you know, I don't want to take up more of your time, but again, thanks a lot for doing this. And yeah, hope you have a wonderful day ahead. And
thank you, Sneha. It's been so lovely talking to you after all these years. And so wish you all the luck as well.
Thank you.
Going on to a new job and so on. So